Good afternoon. I'm Louis Hines, your host for The Weekend, but I'm joined today also by the other host of The Weekend, Angela Kucherga. We have been alternating every other week, but today we decided to do it together. Angela is no stranger to the Southwest. She's been a reporter of television, radio, print, and now she is currently working for the Albuquerque Journal. Angela, thank you for being with us.
Louis, it's a pleasure.
So as a reporter for the Albuquerque Journal, you have a pretty wide area to cover. And not too long ago, after the Christmas holidays, the new president of Mexico was on the border and you covered it. So tell me a little bit about what you found out.
Yeah, so my beat, I'm based here in this region. I cover all of southern New Mexico from Socorro south. And so southern New Mexico, a huge stretch of territory. And, of course, that includes the entire New Mexico-Mexico border. And so this past weekend, Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO to many, was in Ciudad Juárez. He was Saturday, and it was part of a border tour. He went to Reynosa, Juárez, and Tijuana to promote his plan, what he's calling a free zone for the border. And it's really fascinating. His administration sees the border region as kind of this economic spark for the rest of the country. And so there are three components to that. One is they're doubling the minimum wage, which is to almost the equivalent of $9 a day. Of course, that's low for our side of the border on the U.S. side, but in Mexico, that is, you know, doubling is significant. And they are reducing what they call the IVA, the value-added tax. They're slashing that in half from 16 to 8%. So that's another savings for people. And then they're going to make the fuel prices in Mexico, in the northern part of the border, equal to those on the U.S. side, because often they're much higher. And so people come across and buy their gasoline or their diesel on the U.S. side.
And I remember when I was still working in television news where people would go to Mexico, Juarez, to fill up their tanks there because it was a lot cheaper. And as you just mentioned, now it's just the opposite.
It has. Yeah, it's been that way for a while because it was controlled, the pricing, by Pemex, the government oil monopoly. So the price fluctuates according to what the government had set. So now people will have lower prices. Now, this is just for the northern part of Mexico's border, our southern border, and those are the states, you know, on the Mexican side and including several key cities a little further south into the interior of Mexico, but not far south. It's all border concentrated.
So from what you saw following the new Mexican president, tell us a little bit about your interpretation and perhaps how other members of the media, both on this side of the border and on the other side, got from him.
Well, I mean, I didn't get a chance to talk to much media, but he, you know, he was an unknown figure before AMLO ran for office here in the north. People were suspicious of him because they thought, well, he's left-leaning. He doesn't understand trade. He doesn't understand business. But he campaigned very hard. He launched his campaign in Juarez, and he talked to business leaders, trade leaders on both sides of the border, reassuring them that he understood the important binational economic ties. And so this free zone on the border really is something that's welcomed, as seen as a way to recognize the border as an important economic engine for the rest of the country. And he had key members of his team, including the finance minister and others, along for the tour of Juarez, I mean, for the visit to Juarez. He also, you know, there is in Juarez, people were happy to see us focused on the border, but, you know, the state officials pointed out that the border still sends the vast majority of the taxes they collect to Mexico City and don't see as big a benefit. So they wanted him to address that. And also in Juarez, the minimum wage is doubling, it's great, and it will certainly help a significant number of people. But the maquiladora industry already pays above minimum wage, so they said that key industry wouldn't be affected by that.
So what about the average person, citizen in Juarez? What happens to him or her?
Well, I interviewed some people about that, what they thought, and they seem they're looking forward to hoping that these changes in the new year will help their bottom line. I interviewed a young man, 19 years old, who had a dolly, and he's on the Paso del Norte PDN bridge, basically carrying over big shopping bags for people. So he makes good use of that dolly and earns tips doing that. And he said the fact that the minimum wage is going up would help him, and he planned to look for a more steady job. He had just gotten his driver's license, so he thought, maybe I can become a delivery driver and I'll be able to make a steady income. So it could help someone like him significantly.
On the other side of the coin, when President López Obrador was elected, one of the things that he said once he took office is that he was looking at perhaps even cutting the salaries of some of the federal people. And, of course, that didn't go over too well.
Well, the interesting thing he did is he did sell the presidential plane, which had made it quite difficult. Some of the people on his staff were talking about how now they have to catch commercial flights. And having covered the border so many years, I know how hard it is to go from point, you know, going from point A to point B on the border. So they'd have to go. They flew from Mexico City to Monterrey, came up, you know, drove up to Reynosa. Then they had to catch a flight, go back and go back to Mexico City, come back to Juarez. So, I mean, he did sell the plane. He is living in a, you know, regular home instead of the presidential residence. And that's been turned into a museum of sorts to show how the wealthy presidential elite lived. And so, I mean, cutting salaries will be more difficult. He's promised to fight corruption. That's also a very difficult thing to do, especially when it touches, you know, there's overlap with people in key government positions who've benefited from that. So it'll be interesting to see how much of that he can deliver on.
You have lived and worked also in Mexico City. So comparing that to the border region, tell us a little bit about how that is so vastly different.
It's a whole different world. I mean, Mexico City is an enormous city. It's one of the great cities of the world. It's a beautiful place, but it has all the problems of a large urban area, but also, you know, all of the opportunities, which is why so many people from all over Mexico and not to mention the world go there and live there. The thing you see a lot is that all the power really is centered in the capital city. And so often people in the states, they complain about, you know, Mexico City not understanding, especially here along the border. People don't understand us in Mexico City. People don't understand us in Washington, D.C. And that's certainly the feeling a lot of people. We're seeing more understanding of the border because a lot of the issues that both countries are confronting right now involve the large numbers of migrant families who are coming up from Central America through Mexico into the U.S. And, of course, now they're stuck in Mexico under this Remain in Mexico plan that President Trump is promoting.
We are visiting with Angela Cocherga. She is the co-host of The Weekend, and today we're together. But she is also the reporter for the Albuquerque Journal, covers the southern New Mexico as well as the border region. And Angela, as you mentioned, the situation with the migrants and President Trump, there were a lot of people who were kind of wondering how this relationship was going to work because both men seemed to kind of do their own thing their way and very different from the traditional politicians.
Well, in some ways, the two presidents are very similar. They were elected as populists. They said they were not going to – it wasn't going to be business as usual. They were going to really look after the people. And even though one was more on the left, López Obrador, AMLO, and, of course, President Trump, more Republican right, they initially seemed to see eye to eye. I mean, one of the things that AMLO, President of Mexico, noted during his time in Juarez, he said, one of the things I agree with President Trump on is he, in renegotiating NAFTA, asked that salaries on the Mexican side for auto workers be raised so that they're more compatible. They're still nowhere near what the U.S. workers earn, but AMLO said that was great. He was in favor. He said, we may not agree on a lot of other things, but I support him on that idea. There is a real test coming because as more and more people amass on the border, get stuck in Mexico, Mexico's going to bear the brunt of that humanitarian crisis. And there's already some waffling on the part of Mexico about whether they are going to go along with that. Remain in Mexico while you wait for your asylum claim to be heard in the U.S. We'll see if that really comes to fruition.
We've seen a lot of stories on the radio, on television, newspapers about reaction to the caravan that was coming across into Mexico. But we haven't seen a lot of reaction from the Mexican people. What have you found out?
Well, yeah, I know in Tijuana we did see somewhat of a backlash to that large group of people who showed up. People acting very much like anti-immigrant groups in the U.S. saying we don't want these immigrants here. They're going to cause us trouble. And others, of course, reaching out and trying to help. And, of course, along our stretch of border, we've seen the humanitarian responses really come on the part of the people of El Paso and the nonprofits, and namely Annunciation House, working with church groups and others to provide assistance to the families out of their own pocket, no taxpayer funds at all. So different reactions along the border, but as pressure builds and more people arrive and Mexico's not able to absorb all of that, it may create difficulties. And that's where we may see the first big clash between the two presidents.
It's been a while now since this movie came out, but I'm sure you saw it as well, El Norte. And in that film, the perspective that I got from that was that these people were crossing from Central America, and there was a lot of not hate, but almost jealousy by people in Mexico and the United States because these immigrants from Central America were looking for a job, and that job may be theirs.
Well, you know, there have always been economic pressures, and you hear people saying, you know, Mexicans are taking our jobs, immigrants coming across to the U.S. side, and then you may see some, and you've seen some resentment, people in Mexico saying you're going to help these new Central American migrants find work, but what are you doing for us, the Mexican citizens? So there's always some of that, especially when there's an economic downturn. But right now, the economies of both countries are doing well. There actually are huge vacancies in the maquiladora industry, and they would love to have additional workers. So some of that, you know, if Mexico gives the migrants special visas to work temporarily, then that might not be as big an issue. But the other concern, you know, Mexico has also complained about the treatment of immigrants. They're immigrants in the U.S., and Central Americans have long complained that they're treated horribly as they come through Mexico, both on the part of criminals that prey on the immigrants, but also corrupt officials who take advantage of them. So, you know, both countries probably need to look in the mirror and see that they have similar types of issues.
Some of these stories that we've heard in the past about the immigrants crossing over, how they are taken advantage of by the coyotes who charge humongous amounts of money, and then all of a sudden this person who has paid this money finds himself alone or trying to find out how to get across the border, because once they've taken the money, they kind of disappear in some instances.
It depends on the coyote. And the other thing to remember, it's not the mom and pop coyotes of the olden days where people actually knew the families who were coming up and there was a connection and some amount of, yes, it was still people were being paid. But these are now organized criminal groups that move people through Mexico, the same groups that move drugs and other types of contraband. So it is very dangerous, and the migrants are viewed as human cargo. And if they can't keep up, they're abandoned. If they can't pay everything they thought they were supposed to pay, they can be abandoned or even sometimes they've paid and they're held hostage and their families are held for ransom. So you've got to pay more for me to let your relative go. And sometimes migrants are actually killed, murdered by these criminal groups. And being abandoned or being told, I mean, I've interviewed countless immigrants who've been dropped off and said, okay, there's whatever major city they're thinking of. You just walk that way for a little while and you'll be there. And they get lost in the desert, or they think they're, you know, Houston. Two kids from Honduras I interviewed, they've been dropped off in South Texas in the middle of nowhere in the brush. And they're like, oh, we were told we were in Houston. Where's Houston? They were nowhere near Houston.
We are visiting with Angela Cocherga. She is one of the hosts of The Weekend, and today we're together, so we're talking a little bit about her coverage of southern New Mexico and the border region for the Albuquerque Journal. Angela, we are taping the show on January 9th, which is a Wednesday, but last night the president gave his address from the Oval Office. Give me a little bit about your impression and perhaps some other people that you've talked with about how that message was received.
Well, I think the buildup was so big that I think we probably all thought we'd hear more, but it was pretty much more of the same. In fact, the president didn't really talk about the wall until the very end of his discussion after he, you know, laid out his whole plan for securing the border. And, you know, of course, the picture he paints of this, you know, area, borderland overrun with criminals and gangs and, you know, horrible violence is not what we know. Those of us who cover the border, those of us who live along the border, I hate to keep repeating this, but we sound like we're, you know, it's a broken record here. But the border cities on the U.S. side are among, if not the safest, among the safest in the whole U.S. So that idea of a violent border with blood spilled everywhere is definitely not what we're seeing. Now, do criminal organizations take advantage of the border? Do they slip across? Is there contraband? Of course. And that's the nature of any border, and that those issues need to be attacked aggressively. A wall would probably not stop a lot of the drugs we're seeing, the very potent drugs, everything from fentanyl, very deadly, to heroin, to meth. The majority of those types of drugs are coming through our ports of entry.
As far as the immigrants go and what's been happening to them, especially when the Central American caravan, you also covered the tent city in Tornillo, and you saw a lot of different situations there, and you also heard a lot of different stories. Why don't you share that with us?
Well, Tornillo, I was among the journalists who got a tour inside to look at the facilities, the tents where the teens, their teens from 13 to 17, are housed. And, you know, very regimented, very well organized, very clean. But these are giant facilities that probably weren't designed to hold children to begin with, much less for long periods of time. That was supposed to be a temporary measure. Opened Father's Day weekend, ran through Christmas, and now we're finally hearing they're beginning to tear down the tents. And most of those children, if they're not being allowed to go with sponsors, who are usually relatives, they're being sent to another facility in Homestead, Florida. So that temporary facility is finally coming down. It was, doctors said it was not somewhere, mental health professionals, that children should be housed beyond a very brief period, and it was horribly, horribly expensive.
You interviewed Mr. Martinez from the Annunciation House?
Oh, Ruben Garcia.
I'm sorry. Mr. Garcia from the Annunciation House, and a lot of the migrants were housed by the Annunciation House, but again, they only had a certain amount of room, and they couldn't do that, and on Christmas, we had all these immigrants being here, dropped off at the Greyhound bus station, and so all of a sudden, there was panic. Tell us a little bit about what Mr. Garcia shared with you and some of the situations that happened after these people were dropped off at the Greyhound station.
Right. So I interviewed Ruben after, for the weekend, which was great, and he kind of gave us the picture then, and he was anticipating. We continue to see more and more of the families being released by ICE. But I don't think he had any idea that they would be just taken to a bus station and dropped off and said, good luck. That was, he said later, a breakdown in communication because CBP and ICE work very closely with Ruben and other nonprofits to make sure that when they release people, they have somewhere to go. And the people usually stay in the shelters a maximum of 2 days. By then, they're able to get a bus ticket sent by their family members. And again, they're not released just to live their lives and never go back. They do face immigration hearings. They get an ankle monitor on their ankle so they can be tracked. And they're sent on their way because if they have a child, they can't be locked up in normal detention facilities. And the family detention space is very limited. There are only three places, almost always fully occupied. And children cannot be held for more than 20 days. So people are released into the United States. And the criticism is that it means in de facto they can stay here for years because there's such a backlog in the immigration courts.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but was that what was related to during the Obama administration as the Flores Act?
Yes, correct.
And so because these children, as far as what it applies to them, was there a certain age limit they're talking about?
Not age limit. Any child, even with a parent, cannot be held in a detention facility beyond 20 days. Now, there's a different scenario when they're unaccompanied minors or children where they're held in Health and Human Services run shelters, and with the idea of reuniting them with a sponsor, preferably a relative, but if not someone else, most people have agreed, healthcare workers and others, that keeping children in that type of facility long term is not ideal.
Secretary Nielsen visited the border, and she had different things to say, especially after the tragedies that we saw, two children dying in custody. What was the comments that Secretary Nielsen and some of the other people said about these children. What can they do to prevent stuff like this happening?
Well, and that was part of the issue. Her visit was not open to media. We did not hear a comment directly from her. We did not see her while she was here in El Paso at all. But the statement released, again, seemed to point the finger at the families for risking their children's lives and bringing them to the U.S. or and through these dangerous kind of remote crossings. She did institute a new screening process for all children with a big focus on children under 10 years old, because we've had two children die in our El Paso Border Patrol sector area in December. The most recent child, a young boy, 8 years old, on Christmas Eve. And, you know, just a few days ago, a delegation of Congress, members of Congress and one senator, again, were out in southern New Mexico, in Alamogordo this time, looking at the Border Patrol station where that young boy had spent the final hours of his life. He'd been picked up in El Paso with his father. They'd come across with the group illegally from Guatemala, and because of all these overcrowding and space issues, Border Patrol said they had to move him out, and they were holding the boy and his father in a highway checkpoint holding area, which, again, CBP is the first to say these are not facilities designed to hold families.
As far as southern New Mexico, as you mentioned, we saw in November the midterm elections, there were a lot of changes, and one of those is the governor of New Mexico. We have Michelle Lujan Grisham, and you said that she's planning also to tour the area.
Yeah, just confirmed that she will be coming down to look at the border. I mean, she took office at the beginning, first of January, and she's been a very outspoken critic of what's been happening as far as the child deaths in Border Patrol custody in New Mexico. And wants to, we're waiting for details, but get a look herself at what the situation is. And she also had early on, before she took office, when she was governor-elect, said maybe states where some of these children are being held should have some sort of oversight role in making sure conditions are adequate.
As far as your coverage, we've heard in the past, and you and I both worked in television news as well, and sometimes we would have situations on the border, whether it be El Paso, Juarez, or in the area, and a lot of these journalists would come in, cover the story, and they'd leave, and people like you and I had to kind of tell the rest of the story. So some people have complained about parachute journalism.
Yeah, I was just going to say parachute journalism. You come in and you leave. I mean, there is some value. I will say it's been good to have the large number of journalists from all over the country come and actually see the border. Many have no idea. They had no idea that these were giant, you know, El Paso, Juarez, largest binational community in the world, one of them, and right on the border. They're kind of amazed that we're so close. They're also amazed to find out that people don't live in constant fear of their neighbors across the border. I think it's important for them to see also the work done by community groups to help with the migrants, the humanitarian response, and also to see Border Patrol agents and Customs and Border Patrol officers at our ports of entry. How they work, how they do their jobs, and the number of people who come across, not just undocumented, which we constantly hear about, but also the people come back and forth every day legally to go to school, come here to UTEP, many, many students to work, to do business, to shop, to see family members. I think it's important for them to see that back and forth legal flow of traffic and people.
Back in the 1990s, I remember then Congressman Sylvester Reyes, then Border Patrol Chief Sylvester Reyes had started Operation Blockade, and that brought a lot of attention to the border. But again, when some of these journalists came in and just dropped by and then left, they didn't understand, and they were kind of like, wow, I thought this was like a war zone. It's horrible. And as you mentioned, El Paso has been nominated and declared one of the safest cities in America countless times. And people rely on each other, Mexico on the United States and vice versa. And as you mentioned, people come over here to shop and vice versa. And so this is something that has worked for years.
Yeah, I mean, geography is destiny. That's who we are. Our location as a border city has both benefits and, of course, challenges. The parachute journalism, I mean, you and I, I'm sure, it's easy to get frustrated when you see people kind of come down. And I remember seeing one young woman do a live shot and where she was somehow attributing the violence to Juarez to the reason migrants were leaving Central America. And I felt like, well, you need to look at a map. That's, yes, they're in Juarez, but that's not why they're trying to come to the U.S. right now. And by then, the violence had kind of tapered off. But I think, yeah, that people need, if there's a silver lining to all of this attention on the border, is that people are getting more information, more stories, and hopefully a better understanding, if we're doing our jobs right as journalists, about what the border really is, what the real problems are, and what the challenges are.
The challenges of covering the border or any story. I remember when I was working in television news, somebody said, well, if you cover spot news or something that's tragic, you have all the facts there. But it's doing a feature story, a human interest story that requires a little bit more attention because you have to dig deeper and tell the story about that person. And you have done that. The fact that you don't just say, well, all these immigrants came in and they were stopped at the border. You focus on one person with a 10-year-old child or a 5-year-old child. And so we start to see a lot of these human stories, the human side of journalism.
It's important to put a face on the numbers because otherwise people don't. I mean, none of us would understand what's happening. And during the height of the violence in Juarez, when I covered that day in and day out, it was important to get beyond that body count, which was so horrible, but to really show the human face and the human impact on both sides of the border of that tragedy. I remember doing a story back then and someone who had lost a loved one in Juarez. Actually, someone who the consulate killings, he put it very succinctly, and I hadn't thought of that. There was so much talk about spillover violence at that point. And he said, really what we're dealing with is spillover grief. We're dealing with being heartbroken and grieving loved ones who've lost their lives. And so the human cost, whether it's some migration policies or violence or a variety of types of stories, health issues, that it's important to put a face on that story.
And I think somebody, when I was reading watching a documentary about World War II and everything that happened, and they showed some of the people who were affected by the war, the bombings and everything, and they said, this is a 10-year-old child, this is a 5-year-old child, and somebody is their parent, and they've lost. And so when you relate that, you go, oh my gosh, that is so true. And one of the things that we've heard before, if Juarez sneezes, El Paso catches a cold, or if El Paso sneezes, Juarez catches a cold. And that's how dependent we are on each other.
We are, and I think you're right in saying that, it's easy because we're so overwhelmed with information in our day-to-day lives, and we hear about, war, faraway wars and the number of people who've been killed. At some point, people's eyes kind of glaze over, and they can't deal with it, and we have similar situations just here. People hear about the border and they think, oh, more problems, more. That's what we have to do a better job of telling all of the stories on the border, the good things that are happening, the solution-oriented things, the resilience of the border, and not just the tragedies, which are part of the fabric of life. It's everything that we have to cover.
Just out of curiosity, because as you mentioned, when the tornado tent city was up and other situations on the border were happening, we had a lot of not national press, but international press. A lot of people from outside of this area came by. I was just wondering, what do other places like the BBC or Europe, somewhere else, what do they see as far as the border story?
I think it depends on who's coming to cover the story. If they're from Europe, you're right. People have come from all over the country, and all over the world. And so, I think they're interested in also looking at how the migration or the refugee crisis here compares to their part of the world, because there are similar trends. How we're responding to it, how our president responds to it, and so I think that they're trying to figure out what's different, what's the same, and how do we tell this story? But I think there's also a fascination that this is happening, in the U.S. And we do have a very high-profile, controversial president, so that attracts a lot of attention, too.
Angela, thank you so much for taking the time to come in here today.
Thank you, Louis.
We've been visiting with Angela Cocherga. Angela is one of the hosts of The Weekend, and she also covers southern New Mexico and the border region for the Albuquerque Journal. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sines.